Hi everyone, welcome back to another episode of Who We Are. Today's episode is one that I feel deeply about, especially as a parent. Like many of you, I recently watched Adolescence on Netflix, a series that left me deeply unsettled and also very reflective, and I had so many questions on my mind. And I think what stayed with me wasn't just the storyline, it was the question beneath it. How did we get here? And we often talk about social media as the threat, but perhaps the deeper threat is that our young people, our adolescents, our teens feel misunderstood, dismissed, and unseen. At school, at home, or even in the spaces where they most need to feel safe and valued. That's why today I knew I had to speak to Dr. Cheryl Low. She's a psychiatrist who has spent years working alongside adolescents in their most vulnerable moments, helping them make sense of their identity, their emotions, and the pain they often can't articulate. She's also a mother to one teenager and one young adult, and brings both a professional lens and a deeply personal one to this conversation. In today's episode, we're going to explore what today's teens are really carrying beneath the surface, why they turn to the digital world to feel powerful or hurt, and what we as parents, educators, or simply as adults who care can do to be better mirrors, better anchors, and better listeners. Welcome to the show, Dr. Cheryl.
Hi.
So for those of us who may not be as familiar with you and your work, could you share a little bit about yourself?
Oh, sure. So of course, I'm a psychiatrist, and I finished medical school first. I came to medical school in Singapore, and then I did my training in psychiatry as a specialty. And I finished my training in 2008, and I've been a psychiatrist ever since.
Wow.
I worked in Changi General Hospital, and over there, of course, we do the whole range, adults, older people. And then I started the adolescent mental health service there as a subspecialty of the department as a whole.
And which year was this that you started it?
About that time that I qualified as a psychiatrist. So maybe about 2012, I would say, if you want to put a year to it. But it's a service. We sort of started it, we build it up, you know, and at first it always is traditionally a child and adolescent. And so we would see the young, the teenagers together with children from like 7 years old onwards. And I think in my training years, that's the way it was. I think along the way, I started to realize that they were a special group within a group within a group that I particularly enjoyed. And I began to feel that they needed something slightly different.
Yeah.
They were not children. They were not adults either. And putting them, sort of meshing them together with the rest didn't give them a space where they could be treated as I felt they would be better treated or better listened to or better seen as having a particular set of problems. And truly, children have more, say, conduct, developmental, learning kind of problems. Mm-hmm. Adults, of course, have the kind of major mental illnesses of adulthood. And teenagers very much were presenting with things like adjustment problems relating to stresses in their lives, as well as the first episode of what would later be a major mental illness of adulthood. But this would be their first time presenting with such a thing. And I began to feel, and I think very much the ethos of adolescent mental health, is that their first contact with this, they should be understood and treated. They should be helped to understand something which not a lot of teenagers will have to deal with, right? Falling sick is just not a thing for young people. But to fall sick, to understand what the illness is, and to be able to feel that it can be managed, it can be understood, and they can get better. They can continue on that developmental trajectory that young people should naturally have. I think these are the things that make adolescent mental health stand out. Versus just sort of treating it like another depression or another anxiety.
And just to frame the conversation for today, adolescents, will you define them between 10 to 19?
So internationally, of course, adolescence varies a lot.
Yeah.
But I think in Singapore, we were, and when we did it, we were very practical. So we just started at secondary school. as long as you finished your primary six.
Okay.
Then so we started at 13. Secondary school.
13. Okay, so 13 onwards.
That's the way it was at Changi General Hospital where I started this thing up. And then we would go all the way to 19.
Yeah.
And around 18, 19, we weren't too strict about it because the girls, of course, would go university. The boys would be in NS.
Yeah.
But since it was a complete department, then of course they would just naturally transition into adults.
Mm.
But we didn't have to sort of separate them because the same doctor would just continue seeing them all the way.
And at that age, the adolescent stage, they are also most malleable, right?
Yes, a lot of things are changing for them. Physically, of course, they are growing, they're changing. How they look affects a lot of how they feel about themselves, right? Not just for girls, I mean for boys too. Being a short boy or a skinny boy is a stress in itself. And then they are also changing in how they see things, right? We understand that both kids and teenagers are learning things all the time and they have a great capacity to learn. But really in adolescence, they are learning to do more adult type thinking. So they are being able to not just think or learn facts, but they are being able to reflect on what they are thinking, a report on thinking about thinking as it were, right? And not just pick up facts, which we can do. And that's an easier form of thinking. And so it's a positive, right? It allows them to reflect on themselves and all that. And then sometimes it can be a little bit tricky and they might need a little bit more guidance because then they think about thinking about thinking and then they're like, okay, where am I? What am I doing?
Yeah.
And if they have no sort of reflective space for that, no sounding board, then it gets into a little bit of an echo chamber or they ask other teenagers and they're all grappling with the same sort of thing, right? And teenagers do need some adult supervision, presence
guidance
in their life.
Or influence.
Yeah.
Mm.
Which they might not want to say it. And maybe not a lot of adults might see that they need it. So they're so smart. Well, they can learn so many things. They know so many things that I don't even know. But actually, it's not about the things that they know or the ways they can do computer that we cannot or things like that, right? But it's really this sort of thing, right? The space for them to talk about things, for them to hear an adult sort of ideas about it.
And biologically, besides, of course, you know, the physical changes that they're going through, what's happening at that stage for them in their minds and in their brains?
I think they are really developing what we'll think about as, so not just cognitively, intellectually, right? Learning things. And then, like I said, being able to think about things in that metacognition, right? Thinking about thinking ways. But also they are developing a sense of self, right? As a personality as we think about it, right? They are developing an idea of who they are. In that sense, what they're good at or what they're not good at. And it's both are important, right? We cannot be good at everything and we must be able to accept the I'm good at this and I'm not good at that. They are also developing what I like and what I don't, what I approve of and what I don't. And also a sense of what I can do. And so this whole thing becomes personality, as it were, right? Eventually, as an adult, this kind of things become personality. And we develop it partly from biological processes, right? Being able to think abstractly, but also, say, from experiences, from the things they realize they can do.
Right, like interactions
with other people, successes in school, tell them, hey, I can do something.
Mm.
Interactions with their peers, right? Their friends says, hey, thanks for helping me, you know, you did this, it really helped me. Then they are learning from this. They're also learning from their interactions with adults, right? Why do I get scolded all the time? Something's wrong with me. Of course, on the outside, they might say that woman is silly, whatever. But
they're all of that.
Right? If it keeps happening to you, and they're thinking about it, right? Is it me? Is it her? You know, I get scolded all the time. Mm-hmm. They are learning all these things from their environment. And then, of course, like you say, nowadays, the environment consists of the big wide web,
yes,
as it were. So I think it's a process that has been happening throughout, you know, human society.
Mm.
But now we should think about the environment as including the internet, which then makes a lot bigger. a lot bigger space. And it's controlled. I mean, people always say it's uncontrolled, but I think it's controlled by very different things. It is controlled. It's controlled by very different things from maybe what adults today were used to when they were
at that stage.
Younger.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I cannot wait to dive deeper into that. But, you know, like what you shared earlier, I think adolescents at this stage of their lives, they're absorbing and internalizing so much signals from the world. Mm. The peers, the parents, the teachers, the basically just influences around everything. What is it, Dr. Cheryl, that most of us misunderstand about adolescents and their mental health?
You know, I think adolescent mental health is something that we can all understand if we take time to talk to them, to be open to what they have and what they can tell us. Teenagers are very articulate. They are able to say what they are thinking. It does sometimes, like I said, this is a process they are learning. So sometimes it does take a little bit of asking questions, of being open, of going through it again and again. But unlike children, very different from children, they are able to articulate, to say. And I think it's important to come to them with an open mind, not the all teenagers are ... Just like not all adults are any one thing, the teenagers are not all one thing either. And I think they would benefit from that. Their mental health would benefit from just that openness to hear from each one of them. The other thing about teenagers maybe versus adults is that teenagers are still growing and changing. Mm. And so what they are one year, the next year, one month, a few months later is changing, and they are not faking it. They are not, you know, lying or being hypocritical or
they're
something.
Not being inconsistent for the sake of.
They are, and they should be growing and changing all the time. And I think that's why maybe working with them requires that flexibility, that openness.
Right.
Because sometimes they do things which are, you know, downright paradoxical. I mean, you say you want to do well, but why are you spending so much time on your phone, right? But I think we should be able to believe both of them, that they want to do well and that they like spending time on their phone as well.
So the two contrasts can be true at the same time.
We should hold it together. It doesn't always happen the way it might with a adult in their best days. And then I think when we talk about mental health problems and we understand that this is a vulnerable time for them, and then thankfully most of them get through it, but this is a vulnerable time. There are many changes which are natural changes. And then along the way, there are, you know, I think there are events which unfortunately happen, and this is how it is. And they do affect young people. And at that point, they need help. They need more help than maybe an adult. And they do need help to access help, right? That an adult might be more able to get the help that they need. An adult might be in a better position just in terms of resources. A teenager, especially in Singapore, is still very much dependent on the family unit. Yeah. For the kind of day-to-day support, as well as for support to get anything more. And so teenagers are in that bit of a corner where I feel, for example, when children are in trouble, a lot of times the children don't know, the parents know, and then they see and then they bring to a doctor. And that becomes quite a natural way of it.
Yes.
When the teenager, and they can, you know, they can do so many things on their own, they go to school on their own, they can buy things, they can argue with you.
Seemingly more independent.
Yeah, so they don't look like they need help, but actually mental health-wise, you can tell that it would be a very difficult thing for a teenager to find a therapist.
To articulate.
And then to do anything about their circumstances, right? If there's a big problem in school or there's a big problem with their friends, where do they get help from?
As of now, your kids, they are, you told me, a teenager, 21.
Yes. And turning 21 and turning 20. Let me think. 19. See, I've forgotten already.
And for yourself, it's interesting because you have this like dual lens, both as a parent yourself
I'm not sure it's a good thing. Yeah.
How has that journey been like for you? And also, I'm so curious, Dr. Cheryl, were there moments, even with your years of training, that parenting them, especially during the adolescent years, still caught you off guard emotionally?
I think it's something that you know, that you never really become an expert at. And I kind of use this to encourage a lot of the parents that I see because they are at a low point. They are bringing their kid to see a psychiatrist. For many parents, that becomes the mark that I failed. I messed up. That's why I'm sitting in this clinic with this strange woman asking me about my kid. And, you know, there are questions I can't answer. And, you know, why is my kid sad? It must be me. I think, you know, it becomes like that. But I always tell parents, you know, you're always a first-time parent. A lot of them are very successful people at work, with their friends. They are, you know, involved in society. But then I say, but you cut yourself some slack and give yourself some credit. You are always parenting your 15-year-old for the first time. Next year, you will be parenting a 16-year-old for the first time. And the following year, be 17-year-old for the first time. Don't expect yourself to be some sort of completely in charge expert. And then also understanding that not everything's your fault. I think, you know, it is true, family does influence child mental health a lot, but not everything is the parents, right? Not everything is some wrong mothering that you did. And I feel that this kind of judgment, right, leads to that kind of very anxious parenting where you have to do it right, where from the time they are born, you have to like read about, I don't know, everything, breastfeeding, playing with your baby also got correct and wrong. School, you know, everything. Because if you do it wrong, you know, consequences, you'll mess up, you know, look at all those kids. And that's unnecessarily, anxiety provoking. Parents, we do need parents to be calm, happy, involved themselves. They do need to be able to relate to their kid, you know, and not leave it to the experts. no experts, I think.
And, you know, Dr. Cheryl, will you say it's been almost like 20 years in this?
It has. So it's 2008 till now, right? So
amazing. And from what you're observing, especially today, how are adolescents navigating identity, self-worth and belonging?
Nowadays, we really should think about what's closest to them, including the internet, including
their
people.
Devices.
Yeah, their devices, which are the portal, right? That's where the internet comes to them from. And so these are then maybe slightly different because these are not people who know the kid, right? The kid knows these people very well. But these are not, say, people who directly know the kid. And so the things
care
in that individual way. Right, so they are saying whatever they are saying for their own reasons, and it influences our children and teenagers very much, and it becomes part of their world. But in that way, that say the family and friends and school, right? How they treat the kid very much comes from a personal knowledge and relationship and a certain responsibility. But I suppose then people on the internet, right, in general, they don't know the kid. I think a lot of times the intent of things that are available or there is not malicious in that way.
And you're talking about role models, right?
Influencers, or even just your stars, right? Your actors, singers, your models, your celebrities, even people who air their views. I don't think we should think about them as intently malicious to your kid, but they don't know your kid. Your kid is just one of millions of people listening to them. So they have no responsibility to the kid like that. And they cannot see the effect they have on your kid. They're happy to have a listener, but they cannot see that. And so there's no back and forth. There's no relationship. But then maybe in that way, it is a little bit lopsided because last time, the person who has the most relationship has the most influence.
Yes.
But now you can have influence without a relationship. Yeah. I think a lot of teenagers have to deal with how they present themselves to other people, which if you think about it, teenagers always had to. But they were, you know, in earlier days, long ago, it was people in real life. And people that you know, and in that way, it is limited because that's
it's only limited, that many people you can
meet and be in front of. And now you can be in front of so many people at the same time, and you don't even know who you are
who's watching you.
Mm-hmm. I think that increases your level of self-consciousness. It increases your exposure to judgment. It increases your exposure to you know, just like...
Or the need for validation.
Yeah, validation. Where does it come from, right? If you have 10 people in your life and, you know, 9 of them validate you and make you... Then you is good enough.
Yeah.
But if you have 1 million people in your life and 9 of them validate you, you know, it's not the same. You feel lousy. And of course, the 1 million people who don't even know you exist, maybe... They don't have that opportunity to validate you. And how are you going to get validation from somebody who's so important to your life but basically doesn't know you exist?
Wow.
I think it warps, right? I would say warp because I'm used to the old way. But it changes the demands on them, how they behave, what they should do, how they should maintain it, the effort they need to put in. It's harder to relax, I feel. It's harder to relax.
So it's almost like they constantly... have to
perform. I don't know. They have to perform.
It's performative.
I think they have to constantly double think. You know, you can't.
On top of all the changes they are already navigating.
Right. And now you have to think about.
And that also means, you know, besides having to perform for more people, that also means these people have more influence on their lives and shapes them, their identity.
Yeah.
Their values.
Yeah. I would think so, right? Because you just have to, you have to keep it in mind all the time. And I think versus adults, of course, we can say adults are on the internet too. We have to think like, what's my staff, you know, saying about me? But I guess adults have a greater sense of themselves.
And we are more developed.
Yeah, we are fixed, right? We can just say, I don't care more easily. Then teenagers are still trying to figure out who matters, who should I care about.
Or who am I, right?
And so then there's this, they are still figuring it out. And to have to figure it out in this environment, I think it demands a lot more from them.
And on this also, maybe are there any emotional wounds that you see that are becoming more common that perhaps are maybe unnoticed or misread by adults in adolescents' lives?
Sometimes because they spend so much time on the internet and there's so much on the internet that their parents don't so-called relate to, right? And then the parents can kind of see them enjoying the internet. So then parents sometimes, I think this is a time not to step back, but actually to get involved, to offer your teenager a relationship with a real person who really cares about them, to be important in their lives, right? So instead of trying to get rid of the internet, to present, I think, to always be an alternative and a better and a closer relationship to them. Not to see that the internet excludes you and therefore you have to fight the internet. Right?
It's actually, like the devil.
Yeah,
like, or treat it like the enemy.
Yeah, like the enemy. Okay, no, switch off your phone, get off it. The problem with you is that you spend too much time on your phone. Actually, parents and adults need to step in, right? To start building that relationship in real life that they will never get from the internet. We need to present a viable alternative. And I would say that teenagers are not averse to it. They are... What they are averse to is adults who constantly criticize them and tell them the internet is bad. But actually, we have a lot more to offer our teenagers, and we should do it. We should talk to them in real life. We should show up with them.
It's amazing, Dr. Cheryl, that you are the way you're explaining it. It's like, you know, we as parents to be the better alternative.
Yes.
So the internet, it seems like what you're trying to tell us is it's here to stay.
It is,
we have to accept it and not try to just get rid of it.
Imagine if we got rid of it, what would be left? You would still need you. Yeah.
And is it also the way you said it, like to be the better alternative as parents? Is it because at this stage for adolescents, our not grip, but maybe our influence on them becomes lesser as they also turn to
So many other activities and things, which is natural. I think it's natural.
It's natural.
It's healthy.
It's healthy.
Yeah, but don't say, oh no, actually he's not interested in me. You know, actually, you know, they only want to be on the internet.
Or take it personally.
Yeah, in that way, don't step back. Right?
So don't step
back. Stay involved.
Lean in.
Stay involved. Stay in your kid's life because you have something to offer your kid, which they are not going to get from the internet.
Practically, how does that look like?
It means staying in conversation with them. I think just like I said at the beginning, being sort of open to sort of knowing what they have to say. They have things to say. What are they doing on the internet? Is they are expressing themselves. And it's just that on the internet, you know, with a million people, you can always get a few responses.
And immediately, right?
Immediately.
Yeah.
But actually, your kid does have things to say. And be there to listen.
So don't judge also, right?
You're just being
open. On the internet.
I think it's not like kids, you cannot say anything. You cannot criticize your kid. I mean, that's not right either. Your kid's telling you because they want a response.
Mm. And they're also testing what your response would be.
Yeah. And I think we can say our opinion. We can give our perspective. And even if we don't agree, it doesn't have to be critical, right? It is a thing that they are thinking or they have done, right? You can have an opinion on, you can hold your own perspective. You don't have to like, oh, wonderful, great, excellent, good job. Everything is,
don't have to gloss over it.
But you have something to offer the kid and it's not praise and it's not valid. You know, it's a relationship. It's care. It's personal.
Mm.
Don't shy away from it just because it looks like your kid's having more fun on the internet than with you. Unfortunately, parents are maybe not the most fun, but that's not what we have to offer our kids. We offer them something different, but also something that I think they need, that I think that adults who care, that parents, family has a unique place in a young person's life.
And what are some guiding principles that ground you, especially, you know, through the different stages of parenting?
I think the same as when I have patients. And of course, patients, like I said, they come with problems. And sometimes if you're a doctor, then the patients, the problem becomes like such a big
magnified
thing, right? And that's why they came and there's something you have to fix and it becomes that thing. But always with young patients, I always look for and I always find the positive, the strengths. And they are amazing. They have so many talents. They are curious. They are creative, much more than adult patients. They are fun. They are open. They are changing, right? And actually, that's a great thing about teenagers. Of course, you try to make sure they don't change for the worse.
It
could go both ways. But then you remember that actually, then they have so much capacity to do good. So I think with the kid as well, then you look for the positives, right? When there's a bad day, when they didn't do well in Chinese,
when they misbehave,
when they argue with you, when they are being difficult, then you try to remember the positives and to remember that they are both there at the same time, right? One of them is the sort of the bigger problem now, but actually, Did your kid suddenly become uncreative and a completely different kid just because right now we don't agree on, you know, something? No, they are both concurrently true.
Mm.
And so when we relate to the kid and relate to the patient, we relate to the whole person. I think that has helped me. It helps me to to see beyond the current problems, to realize that there is a great a future trajectory, that there is an ongoing relationship between me and this other person. One is my kid, the other one is my patient, but there is an ongoing relationship between me and this young person.
Amazing.
And we are working on that, right? We're working through our current problems towards that.
So to remember that this is just like a chapter in
this is a chapter,
a book of many chapters,
yes,
right?
And we are very lucky with teenagers, we are at the beginning chapter. And what we do has so much potential to make the later chapters much more positive.
You know, very interestingly, I wanted to ask you, kids who, just now you talked about social circle and influence. We have parents, we have teachers, we have peers. You also talked about kids who are influenced by like churches and the groups, right?
Yep.
So are there any data points that have been interesting just in general that kids who actually perhaps have like organized religion groups versus those that don't, or kids that come from broken family or parents are going through something?
Sure. So actually the risk factors for mental illness as a glob, blah, are definitely genetic. So we understand that there is a high heritability.
And is it hereditary?
That's what we mean by genetics. There's a big component of whether you get major depressive disorder, schizophrenia, anxiety disorders. There's a big genetic component to that. It doesn't doom you, right? Your mother is depressed, you will be depressed. What it means is that it increases your
more
risk.
More susceptible.
Yeah. It also doesn't mean that you will get exactly what your mother got. Your mother was mildly depressed. Doesn't mean you will be mild. You could be much more seriously depressed. Schizophrenia also increases your risk of depression. So it doesn't breed true, as it were.
Yeah.
But we have to, I think, understand that these things do run in families. And we always talk about gene-environment interaction, which means that the genetics is a risk factor. The environment is also a risk factor. Having both of them is more than the additive risk of each of them.
So it doubles.
It increases the more than the sum of its parts.
Yeah.
And you can easily see how that happens because from your parent, you not only get the genes, you get the environment. You get the mom who is depressed. Not only you got her genes, which increases your risk, you also get the fact that she is less attentive.
Present. So it's like nature and nurture.
Wow. And then we understand that they mix together to make things much worse. And then they tend to not be able to work so well. Therefore, they tend to earn less money. Then we come into a certain social deprivation section of things. And then that becomes your neighborhood. And if you live in a less good neighborhood, then you're exposed to a lot more crime, violence, the way people deal with each other, addiction. Then you realize that it one thing leads to another. So these things are not separate risk factors. They each of them accumulate. So unfortunately, right, that means that bad things happen in groups.
Mm.
Yeah. Mm. I think that's maybe how we see this. So certainly genetics is one thing.
Yeah.
Socioeconomic, it doesn't mean, not that poor people are more likely to be depressed. That is only true for extreme poverty. So that means at a point where you don't have enough to eat, we have inconsistent shelter. So not being sort of not rich in itself.
Yeah.
So extreme poverty.
Yeah.
Certainly exposure to violence.
Yeah.
And traumatic events, and by that we mean major traumatic events, violence, abuse when you are less than 6 years old. So the early childhood years, we understand, is a big vulnerable age.
For trauma.
And then, of course, but not just like after that, you can deal with anything. Certainly the whole of childhood. So those sort of things are big things. We don't actually have information about organized religion or school. But if you think about it, they are not likely to be data points or factors in themselves. So children from more stable families, from better neighborhoods, who are less exposed to violence and abuse, are also more likely to be in school and more likely to be in organized religion. They are associated. They are not separate points.
Got it. Dr. Sher, this is so interesting because then I'm thinking, you know, like, are all schools good schools? And maybe also for the adolescent stage, you know? Like, there are so many forces of there are so many forces that shape their identity and basically shape them.
Mm-hmm.
You talk about parents, peers, schools, social media. How do they compare in weight and impact in this time of their lives?
I think we should remember that despite social media being like completely omnipresent, right? That actually our children still spend a lot of their growing up and young person life in school.
In a physical environment.
In a physical environment with a real person who is, you know, for most parts, stable, knowledgeable, and caring.
Sound, yeah.
Right? And so has that opportunity to do so much good, to provide kids with a experience that they might not have from their families, unfortunately. And that's an opportunity. So I think it is still a thing. It always was. And we should see it as an opportunity. How to make the most of the opportunities? I'm a big proponent that children should have a stable teacher in school.
Yeah.
So for example, versus...
You're talking about like a teacher that is with them throughout the year.
Not even, you know, but maybe at least the whole year, a teacher, like the whole concept of a form teacher, right? Who knows this certain bunch of kids and will see them through a year, sometimes 2 years. And I think that's how they get that support,
stability.
Right? I think sometimes in the economies of scale thing, there's a tendency maybe to group large numbers of teenagers, lecture them all together, and then, you know, leave them to project work by themselves. I think we can see that would maybe be a more efficient way. I don't know. I'm not an educator. That might be a more efficient way. You know, it makes economic sense. Mm. But I think we lose that when we say, if we put them in a sort of a class according to their needs, that might be better for their learning.
Academic needs,
academic needs. But then you risk breaking students up, you know, you spend one period with this teacher, blah, 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 blah. You don't have a consistent
teacher. And that is important.
And you lost that. So any school system that, you know, can give the kid a teacher who, you know, at least for one period of every day, sees that kid throughout time. I feel that is something that the kid gets from school that is beyond academics, which, yes, I understand is not the most efficient use of teacher manpower. But we lose something when kids have nobody who is always looking out for them.
Amazing.
In that non-academic way.
Hmm. And why do you think, from your experience, kids turn to social media, the internet, or even gaming? What are some underlying or emotional needs that they're trying to meet?
I think they do get, number one, they get entertainment, so they don't have to think about negative things all the time.
Hmm.
Number two, they make friends online, which they might not have in real life.
Mm.
And sometimes when you are depressed and anxious and you don't go to school and you don't perform in school so well, it's harder to make friends in school, or you just feel lousy about yourself in school. Then you go online, you game well, or you just chat well, or you know all the social rules of the online world. and people are, you know, people like you, they keep in touch with you. It's, you know, why wouldn't you? Young people need friends, and if it's easier online, and a lot of times a lot of them will tell me it's just they don't feel as anxious online. If they don't have to turn on their camera, they don't feel so anxious, and people are more accepting, right? They don't need to know everything about you, and you can just show up on a good day and just you know, be your best self, and yeah. people respond to
accepted.
You and be accepted.
Yeah.
Whereas if you're in school, you have good days, you have bad days. On a good day, people still remember your bad day and yeah. they're like, what's up with you, right? And you don't want to explain that. So online, the demands are a lot less. They're a lot less. I think we should give that, you know, the internet has become a place where our kids can feel good because it's a lot less demanding in some ways. You can show up on a good day and everybody will just take you as you are.
Yeah. So how should we as parents also in this case, I love what you said earlier about being that better alternative for our kids. In this particular example, how can we step in to ensure that that our kids are not just, you know, fulfilling all the emotional needs from other sources?
Yeah. I think, unfortunately, it then becomes that you are playing the long game. Parents are always playing the long game. That on a good day, we are there. On a bad day, we are also there. But we are there on a bad day and we are allowed to be there on a bad day because we were there on
all
a good day. And we are allowed to be there on a good day because we were there on the bad days. And so it becomes a little bit of a, it is effortful. It definitely requires a lot of effort from parents.
Yeah.
And sometimes it's demoralizing because you see that, you know, they don't really want to talk to me. But being there, sort of reminding them, you don't have to sit down and have a heart-to-heart talk every day. I think that's also quite tiring. But you show up, you say hi, you check in, you show them that you actually your demands are not great. You just want to make sure they're okay. You're okay, you're okay. Well, back off, right?
Back off,
it's a good day. They're okay. Leave them alone.
And so when you talked about being there as parents on the good days and the bad days, how should we show up during the bad days? For example, what if really our kids are testing waters to try and tell us something to gauge our reaction, you know? How should we, if you really hear something that you may not want to hear from your kid, how should we respond?
I think it still goes back to the same, that you get them to say as much as they want to say, not as much as you want to know or you want to hear, right? So we always ask questions, right? Don't jump in with the solutions. We always ask questions. And then sometimes the question will be, do you want to tell me more? And if the answer is no, then you should, I think we can take it as a not right now. Or I don't want to talk about this. Do you want to talk about something else? You know, I think we hang on to our anxiety, of course. We hang on to our anxiety. We don't try to interrogate the whole story out of them. Or we don't have to worry that if you don't tell me everything right now, you know, you're going to kill yourself.
Race to the worst case scenario.
I think if we've built a relationship with our kid over the years, then it's always a continuing conversation. We have never heard 100% of it. And then we are okay. We can sit with that. We know that there's a problem. And we are willing to continue the conversation at a certain time, a certain pace, and in a certain scope. And I think that that's an important kind of conversation to be able to have with your kid. And it starts when they are young, and we should keep it going.
And still sit with them even when they give one-worded answers
or
don't want to.
One's very good.
Yeah,
they're still sitting there.
Yeah.
Don't want to talk also can. They're still there. I find this, you know, it's a privilege to be a parent, for me to be a psychiatrist. They came, right? Sometimes they don't want to talk. Sometimes they don't want to listen, right? So there's always this ongoing changing dynamic. Not every time is for talking. Not every time is for listening. Not every time is for doing anything. A lot of their problems, I have no solutions. What can you tell a kid when their parents are fighting and their whole family life is going you know, down the drain? I have no solutions.
Yeah.
Maybe that's a time to listen. Sometimes they don't want to talk. Maybe that's a time for me to say something. right? But there's that ongoing relationship. And I think we should see it as we are playing the long game.
Mm. And to allow them to be seen and be heard.
Be heard. Yeah.
You know, in the Netflix show Adolescence, you know, at the very end, the child, what he committed was he stabbed his female classmate to death. Mm. And parents were also wondering, like, how did he get here? You know, I thought he was safe. Yes. He's at home every day.
We give him everything.
We give him everything. Yeah. What are some of the unseen signs or signals that we miss as parents and that leads to this, like, emotional implosion?
I think from my experience, I would say that a lot of times, maybe by the time we get there, there are some things that parents have noticed throughout the years. And then maybe they just felt that they felt helpless to change things. They felt that this was inevitable. This is how things are nowadays. So they...
For example,
you know, that your kid does not talk to you, that you don't know where your kid is, right? Mm. Sometimes you feel that maybe, you know, I should respect his independence or privacy. But actually, there are some of these quite old-fashioned ideas, right? It's not wrong to ask your kid, where are you going, yeah. right? You know, to ask, how are you? To know what your kid is up to.
Mm.
And if you find that you can't even get that, it doesn't mean that your kid is definitely having a problem, but that speaks to the relationship again, that you don't know and you feel you can't know.
Yeah.
I think then this is, you know, a time to think about whether there's a problem. Mm. And parents, of course, can start by just asking their friends or, say, older relatives or reading up about these things, because really we're nobody's an expert, right? Maybe there's nothing happening to your kid, but it tells you something about the relationship.
Mm.
If this young person who's living in the house that you love mm. and you're providing for and you care so much mm. and you are able to help and support,
mm.
but you don't know anything about their lives, you can't talk to them. I mean, really, that's not really what we should accept as okay. And we should start to look into it, to build that relationship, yeah. to make baby steps.
Yeah. Do you find that, you know, a strong parent-child relationship mm-hmm. can really cut through the noise?
It does.
What does that look like in real life?
It does in so many ways. It allows the kid to be heard. Right. So the kid can say anything, knowing that they don't have to worry that the parent will get upset. I said this. They don't have to worry that they will, you know, scold me or judge or used against me. Definitely. They don't have to worry that they'll be misunderstood. So the kid feels much more open to say it to me and to say it in front of the parent. And then we find that parents, when they have a good relationship with the kid, they have noticed something themselves, right? They're more attuned. They have noticed things. And some of the things the kid hasn't noticed, right? Mm-hmm. Sometimes when we are depressed or we're anxious, we're all caught up with our own symptoms. The parent has noticed something and that becomes very helpful
for the kid. Early intervention.
Yeah, for the kid, for the doctor to understand, right, what's been happening at home.
Yeah.
I think then that also allows the parent to really... Okay, to acknowledge that the kid has a big problem and my kid is struggling, and then to come at what can I do? And very often, if you're already on the background of a good relationship, then you know what you can do and you have opportunities, you have levers, you know what would help your kid or how to help your kid.
Right.
And so on the background of a normal good relationship, mm. we are so much more able to intervene when there is a mental illness, when there is a much bigger problem.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I think that really helps also, like, the child feels so supported
yes.
in this journey.
Yes. We cannot choose our illnesses, unfortunately, and we cannot choose, like, bad things happening.
Mm.
We choose our responses. And there are so many opportunities in the life of a kid, for the adults, for the parent, to make a positive choice.
You know, Dr. Cheryl, how do we help teens build a strong internal compass and one that is not, like, easily shaken by external validation or you know, shame or what they're going through in their life.
I think that that very much speaks to how they built it up, right? The end product, the kind of compass you have speaks to how it was built up. If it was built up consistently from an adult or a community that showed you care, that didn't just say, oh, you're great, you're wonderful, but also how they treated you, how they behaved towards you, how they taught you things, how they corrected you, then the compass is real. It was built on a firmer foundation than something that, you know, is more like rah-rah, more like pep talk, or more like things that you read about, or even just things that you hope you are. Right, that kind of compass, which is very changing. So how kids turn out is really how they were, how they experience the world around them, how they learn about themselves is they learn it from everything that happens to them around them while they are growing up. And so that stability, right, that strong internal compass comes from, it is not a one-off thing and it's not a technique. Is a everything, everybody, all the time. You know, it's a consistent thing that they have experienced in their formative years. And teenagers are still in their formative years.
And I love it because like you shared earlier also, like actually teenagers are still a relatively early chapter in their book of life. Where we can still, you know, influence them in the direction that we want them to go.
Which would be good for them, which would be a gift that we give them.
You know, for a parent who perhaps is listening to you and she feels, he or she feels out of depth, what are some small shifts that we can make to build, you know, to improve the connection and understanding with our child?
I think we have this concept in psychiatry and child psychology called good enough parenting. You don't have to be perfect. You don't have to have the latest parenting techniques and to know about kids. And I think just now we talked about that when we talked about being an expert. That a lot of how we people raise their kids is good enough. And good enough really means good enough. It means good for your kid. Don't stop. Don't doubt yourself. Don't withdraw and let somebody who knows better or something that seems to be entertaining your kid or making your kid happier do that job, right? It's quite irreplaceable. I do think there's a lot to be said for communities of parenting, right? Your friends who are going through the same thing. There's reading about things, but again, there's no need to feel like other people know your kid better than you. They don't. They know about child
in
development.
General,
they have textbooks, they read research, but there's your one kid. Your one job is your one kid, right? Or however many kids that you happen to have, and you are the expert. You're the expert parent on it. And I think it does a lot to get involved, to keep engaging your kid. Because actually, even for myself, I learn about teenage mental health from talking to teenagers. Not from textbook.
No, right?
Well, half from textbook, right? And
then the rest of it may not even be relevant today.
It's gone. My textbook was 10 years old by the time I read it, right?
Yeah,
and I learn about the kid that is in front of me by talking to the kid.
You've seen so much of what's broken, but what are you hopeful about?
I am hopeful because over the years, then actually, yes, most young people do get better. They work through their problems. Sometimes it takes, you know, 1 or 2 years. I see them as incredibly energetic, full of potential, full of ability to change. I think that's something we definitely want to message to them. When we meet them and they are at a low point, when they have problems and they don't know, right? And I don't want to promise them that it will turn out like this or like that.
Yeah.
But we understand that there's so much potential to change. What we have is the ability right now. You are in front of me. We have certain resources. We don't have everything that we want, but we have certain resources. We have certain opportunities. We have certain choices that we can make and we can do it together. And, you know, there will be some bad days and some good days ahead of us. but we can do it together. It is not hopeless. Mm. We can try. You know, look, you have your parents. They did bring you here. Okay, maybe you don't like them very much. Maybe yesterday they scolded you. But we have, you know, we have something together here. Mm. I think we want to allow them that hope. And in that way, we are adults. We have seen more of life. And they are young people. Maybe we don't need to expect them to carry that hope because it doesn't come from experience.
Yes.
But we have that experience. We should use that to give them hope and bring them along with us.
And you know, if you could have a billboard message, if you could have a message on a billboard that, you know, anyone in the world could see, what would your message say?
I think maybe it would say hello to your kid today. Yeah, I think it's in the small things. It's in keeping that relationship going every day. Good day, bad day, boring day. Say hello to your kid today.
Oh.
Because, yeah, we dismiss too easily these sort of small things. We want the techniques, the strategies. We want the up-to-date. We want to be cool parents, right? But, you know, it's all based on relationship. And what kind of relationship do you have if some days go by and you just didn't say hello, didn't touch base with somebody that you care about so much, who lives in your house, who needs your, at a very basic level, needs your food and money kind of thing,
yeah.
Right? Encourage parents. I would encourage parents that this is something they can do every day. And it's an important thing. It's an important thing. And it'll be fun. It'll be nice.
Yeah.
It's not terrible.
And there is that small shift,
yeah,
that can compound when
so.
Done daily.
I hope,
yeah,
so.
Thank you, Dr. Cheryl.
Thank you.
Thank you so much for this conversation.
Been fun.
Yeah.